Some owners of a food truck or people who wanted to start a little food truck business in Detroit. And the Detroit Press actually interviewed them about the process they went through to get their vehicle licensed. And here's what these would-be food truck operators said. They said, it took us 3 or 4 months. You had to come up with a plan review, the same as you would with a bricks-and-mortar restaurant. They wanted to see your whole layout. They wanted to know every single piece of equipment, dimensions, specs, where you're buying it. You have to have a spec sheet for every single thing, the exact model. And they continue. They wanted to know your food sources and the entire flow of the food. We had to say where we were getting the chicken, or that we were getting the chicken, for instance, from U.S. Foods. And then it's, okay, you buy your chicken frozen. What's your thawing process? How do you cook it? How do you hold it? How do you serve it? We had to go through every single menu item and do the exact food flow. They say you have to do this, 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 and this. So you go back and you do this, 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 and this, and then you keep redoing it. The final step was the lighting. We didn't have a lighting chart. They wanted to know where the lights were going and what's going to be covering the lights. We were amazed at the amount of steps, they said. But then they concluded, but you know, it's cool because once you actually receive the license, you have a sense of accomplishment. So, you know, other would-be entrepreneurs might have abandoned this effort in the face of all the process they had to go through. But it's clear that these people, having persevered, they now have an interest, right, in preserving the regulatory barriers that they've had to clear in order to get their business started. We usually think of regulation as a problem of the political sector. Special interests compete in the political arena to have regulations imposed or deposed or adjusted in some way that advances their objectives. These rules can be local ordinances, state regulations, federal laws, and they govern everything now from what we can't do to what we must do, including, of course, now purchasing health insurance. So, why are we discussing regulation at a meeting about philanthropy? And there could be lots of different answers to that question. For one, regulations affect nonprofits and how they operate. Regulations can also affect the opportunities of those on the lowest rungs of the economic ladder, like those food truck operators who are faced with by restricting entry or creating barriers to entrepreneurship. But regulation actually has just a profound impact on the entire economy and on our freedom generally in a way that influences who we are and what we can accomplish as a society. A 2010 report commissioned by the Small Business Administration estimates the annual costs of regulation at $1.75 trillion. Those costs do not come without a significant economic and I think it's also fair to say a cultural impact. They call it the nanny state for a reason, right? Fortunately, though, there are lots of ways that nonprofits can exert influence over the regulatory process. They can conduct research. They can engage in advocacy. They can undertake litigation. And today we have with us three people who represent nonprofits that work in various ways to push back against regulations that take a huge toll on our ability to prosper both as individuals and as a nation. You have their bios and the packets you received, so I'm not going to repeat that information here. Two of our speakers are lawyers, and the third is a certified urban planner. But please remain seated anyway.
I'm a recovering
Okay, fair enough. Philip Howard is going to be our first speaker, and he's one of the lawyers. He's the founder of Common Good, an organization devoted to the premise that needless bureaucracy crushes common sense in schools, hospitals, the workplace, and other core institutions. Chip, I'm going to ask you to go second, if you don't mind. Chip's the co-founder and president of the Institute for Justice, a public interest law firm that litigates on behalf of individuals whose basic rights are compromised by government policies, rights including free speech, private property, and the right to earn an honest living. Lynn Gilroy, down at the end, is director of government reform How does it feel to have your title be an oxymoron?
I get a lot of questions on that one.
Director of Government Reform at the Reason Foundation, and in that capacity works with elected officials to introduce market efficiencies into government operations and enhance performance and accountability. As we all know, these last few years have been especially challenging ones for advocates of reduced regulation, but I think that makes the efforts of these three individuals all the more appreciated and impressive. So, Phil, I'll let you start off.
Well, thanks, Kim. It's nice to be here. It is sort of a mixed feeling. Sometimes you feel you're pushing the boulder up a hill and, you know, it's impossible to do anything about it. On the other hand, never, I think, has the ground been more fertile for this discussion and for change. I mean, Americans, we just did a survey that we haven't released yet, which shows that the American people are overwhelmingly open to the idea of overhauling government radically, that they think it's broken. It isn't just that only 9% or 8%, you know, approve of the congressional performance, but they actually believe that there's something fundamentally wrong with the system. And our point is it cuts a little against the ideological arguments of both political parties, because our point is that the main cost of regulation, or the largest cost, is not the direct cost of bad regulation, which there is a lot of inefficient regulation. It's actually the second level cost. It's sort of what Charles Koch was talking about at lunch. The second level cost, which have rendered, really at every level of society, people powerless to do what they know makes sense. And so it occurs teachers spend hours every week filling out forms nobody's ever going to read. They've completely lost control of a classroom in inner cities because of bureaucratic requirements in the name of due process that effectively undermine their authority to kick a kid out immediately who's disrupting the classroom and such. Doctors go through the day with a little lawyer on their shoulders. You know, every patient is a potential plaintiff. Federal government just increased the number of federal reimbursement categories from 18,000 to 140,000. Including 21 separate reimbursement categories for spacecraft-related injuries. Incredibly useless. Small business, it's an exercise in frustration if you're a small businessman. You get whipsawed. As Kim was saying, and this could go back and forth and back and forth. And many small businesses, if they can get away with it, just ignore the regulation. They couldn't afford the lawyer to tell them what the regulations are. There's just too much of it. And so there's a tendency to think of government as the villain and all the people I just mentioned as the victims, and they are in a sense. But if you go inside of government, they're powerless too. So Obama now, for the second time, has said he wants to stimulate the economy with infrastructure projects. It'll take him a decade to get approval for any significant infrastructure project, you know, like a pipeline. He can't do it, just like he couldn't do it last time. It'll take 2 or 3 years just to fix a broken down bridge, like the one from Louisville, Kentucky over to Indiana, before you can start work. His term will be over. So the president can't do anything. Nobody actually talks about how you manage government. Well, government is completely unmanageable. You can't hire people sensibly. There's this 19th century rule, the rule of three. Everybody takes a written test. You can pick somebody only from the top three. It doesn't matter if they're competent or not, or have a bad reputation, or some better person scored less well on the test, but has a great, you know, did a great job in the prior job. You have no discretion to do that. You can't reassign them because assignments are determined strictly by seniority and other thick rules. You can't tell them what to do. That's designated by work rules. So New York City has over 1,000 job classifications. One classification has people putting numbers on a piece of paper. Another one has someone else adding them up. I'm not kidding about this. And you can't fire them at all unless they commit a crime. So here you have over 20 million people who work at all levels of government in this country, whose direct compensation cost is $1.5 trillion per year. who are virtually unmanageable. Now, how inefficient is this system? It's all internal regulation. How inefficient? 10% inefficient? 30% inefficient? I mean, it's hugely inefficient, and this is not even on the political agenda for either party. And so this system, which is in which no one's in charge, the rule book is in charge, has accreted over the course over the last century, really since the Industrial Revolution, but with great accelerated speed over the last 50 years or so. There's now 140 million words of binding federal law and regulation, several billion words of binding state law and regulation, governing things you can't possibly even imagine. All you have to do is actually pick a book off the shelf and start reading it and say, why is that there? Why is this law? Most of it is obsolete. Most of it's way too precise. It tries to tell people exactly how to do everything. And it's suffocating our society. Suffocating schools. You can't manage it. Great thing about charter schools is that they don't have the rules. It's suffocating our hospitals. It's suffocating religious institutions. You can't put an arm around a crying child anymore. You'd have your career ruined. That's the rule. So to us, the villain is this blob. And so our solution, if you will, is that we need to completely remake the system. And basically on the principle of replacing bureaucracy with human responsibility and accountability. You can get rid of 95% of the words of law without any problem whatsoever and change not one goal of the law. I mean, a lot of goals that need to change, but you don't have to change any of the goals. If law looked more like the Constitution and less like the tax code, you could actually give people responsibility if you could hold them accountable, which you can't today. Hold them accountable. And you actually could begin to create a system that works better. Now, we've been working at this organization that I started 9 years ago called Common Good, with help from some of you and other foundations. Our largest donor was the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And we did a project, joint venture with the Harvard School of Public Health to design a new system of justice for healthcare, which basically involves abandoning the system of current system of justice, creating administrative courts, with judges, not juries, who make written rulings on standards of care, with an appeals process, where the whole point of it is not to stop lawsuits, but to make them consistent with medical standards. So doctors can actually trust the system, which is an essential condition if you want to start remanaging healthcare. So they don't have to be defensive all day long and all that kind of stuff. You would think this would be very controversial, and we haven't succeeded in having it happen yet. However, after doing a number of forums, we now have virtually every patient safety advocate as part of our group. The largest consumer groups, AARP and others, are now part of our group. Obama has broken from the trial lawyers and put money in his budget to do special health courts. It's a big, I mean, that took a certain amount of work. So it hasn't happened because the trial lawyers have bought off one of the parties. I forget which one. But it will happen. We have a project with the city of New York to streamline small business regulations. We have a whole bunch of regulations we're in the process of rewriting. We had a project, believe it or not, jointly with the teachers union and the New York City Department of Education to completely remake the procedures for school discipline, to restore the power of teachers. So one actually place of common interest for the teachers union, to restore the power of teachers to maintain order in a classroom. So those are the kinds of things that need to happen, but it needs to happen across the board. It's not going to happen, and we're not going to make it happen, because the public isn't quite yet in the mood to force Washington to do these things. They're getting close. So our vision of this is that we're starting a campaign called Start Over. We're just doing our first forums right now, where we're taking these subjects one by one, getting leading experts, getting them taped, getting magazines to write about them. We've already done one cover story for Newsweek. I'm talking to Time about doing a magazine, a whole feature. I've been on the Jon Stewart show twice in the last year talking about this. Believe it or not, he's on board with this. So get experts together talking about the need for overhaul, come up with proposals, get media to write about the need for change so you actually begin to tee up a vision of what this might look like. Hopefully embolden some people in the candidate, in the debates to talk about it. And then, either with good leadership and or a really terrible crisis, we will have the opportunity for the change that's needed. Because again, I don't think you can reform the system by tweaking it. And hopefully we will have teed up enough issues working with groups like CHIPS and the Reason Foundation and others, and working with think tanks from both sides to get them involved in coming up with the solutions in each of these areas. And hopefully we'll have enough of a thought leadership base and enough of a vision up, teed up, that when the time is right for big change, and it will happen, then it will go in this direction. And that's our goal. We're doing it with foundation and private support. And again, I think it's a great opportunity. It's a great discussion to have because the system, as every American knows, is broken.
Why are you so confident this change will happen? I'm glad you are, but where does that confidence come from?
It comes from history. You know, regimes fail. They fail when they can no longer serve the public. It's happened to rulers throughout history. It happens every 30 or 40 years in our country's history. We've had a change in the social contract because things ran their course and failed. The last was the Rights Revolution, then was the New Deal, then was the Progressive Era, the Civil War, Jacksonian democracy, almost like a metronome. So things do change, but they change at a time when people get offended by racial discrimination or whatever, and then we have this big period of change, and it goes a little overboard. And we're suffering from, or a lot overboard, some of the collateral effects of trying to make everything perfect through law. And so, and now we've got to come back and restore human control. But it's all about people. You know, only people, rules don't make anything happen. There's this great quote from Edison, hell, we ain't got no rules around here. We're trying to get something done. You know, but that's true in life. And what's happened in this society is we've just been crushed by it.
I have to tell a quick story before I let Chip start the talk about discipline in schools. A couple of years ago, my son was in high school, and he was not a model student in his Spanish class, in which he hated it. He didn't want to be in it. And so the teacher dragged me in after school one day, and I'm sitting there with Will, and the teacher told me this story about how he kept, you know, twitching like this, and it was driving her crazy. So she apparently went over to him and, you know, touched his hand, and in front of the whole class, he says, you can't do that. I could sue you.
Yeah,
so, yeah exactly. So, but, you know, the kids kind of know this, and they know how to game the system, right?
I mean, 78% of the middle and high school teachers in America have been threatened with lawsuits by their students.
Wow.
A survey by Public Agenda. Not that they would sue or they would win if they did, but it's just an indication of the corrosion of authority that's virtually complete in the school system.
Thanks, Phil. Chip?
Well, thanks, Kim, and thanks to the Philanthropy Roundtable for inviting us here today to be part of this panel. You know, Phil touched on a number of very important points, and I totally agree with him about the nature of the proliferation of rules and the way that micromanages what ought to be ordinary and voluntary human behavior. But I would offer that there's one set of rules that we ought to never lose sight of, and indeed ought to do everything we can to rehabilitate their presence in our everyday lives, and that is the rules set forth in the Constitution, because those, after all, govern the game in the way in which government plays the game as it affects us. And when it comes to regulation, you know, a lot of times people talk about its effect on the economy, and they think about, well, one of the problems that you have is that there's not enough capital available, and the regulations make it harder for people to get capital and that sort of thing. And that is true. But it's also true that in order to get capital, the first thing you have to have is a legal business. And it turns out that's not so easy for a lot of entrepreneurs, and that's where I'm going to get back to the Constitution in a minute. You know, back in the 1950s, about 1 in 20 occupations in this country required a license or permit from the government before you could engage in that activity. you know what it is today? It's close to 1 in 3. Close to 1 in 3 occupations in this country require permission from the government before you can engage in that. Now, they've proliferated to cover all sorts of what would seem to be very run-of-the-mill entrepreneurial activities, ranging from African hair braiders to casket retailers to taxi cab drivers to interior designers to computer repair people. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And these things have really two ways in which they occur. One is that these licensing and permitting laws, though purported to be in the name of public health and safety and sometimes having such goals fulfilled with their requirements, oftentimes condition entry in such a way that it becomes enormously burdensome on the individual trying to comply with what it takes to get into the business, or they simply outright prohibit new entrants and create cartels. All of this, in turn, then, has a predictable effect of raising costs for the consumers and the entrepreneur, and making there fewer participants in the economy at a time when it's crucial that we have more economic activity. And interestingly enough, as these laws have proliferated, they've had an increasingly large and detrimental impact on people of very modest means, because it's, after all, very hard for people of modest means to comply with what become increasingly technical requirements, so that it's not just doctors that have to have a lawyer on their shoulders, it's everyday business people. And the what you see is something Phil mentioned, and that is what amounts to really the largest act of civil disobedience going on every day in this country, and it's not Occupy Wall Street. It's hardworking men and women who say the costs of compliance are too great. I'm going to do this anyway. And if you want to see that in action, go to any modest income community in this country. And by modest, I mean just working class or lower income community, and start noticing the storefront occupations that are going on there. You'll see manicurists. You'll see informal taxi transportation arrangements. You'll see all sorts of people who are doing things that really require licenses. But when you look into it, it turns out they don't have those licenses. They're operating just below the radar screen enough because they're not able to grow. They're not able to really hire a lot of people. They're not doing much to roil the waters. They're just squeaking by, if at all. Now, let me illustrate with the practical realities of that with just a couple of examples to show you just how ridiculous it actually does get. It turns out that in Louisiana, like in a number of states, that you have to be a fully licensed funeral director in order to sell what amounts to a box, otherwise known as a casket. Now, what does it take to become a licensed funeral director? Well, it takes a year of apprenticeship, learning how to embalm bodies, and if you want to actually run a business that sells caskets, you then have to have an embalming room and build your business according to the specifications that require a great deal of attention to detail from these, like Kim was talking about, the food vendors. Well, why would that happen? Well, we know why it happens. It turns out that, of course, caskets are the largest profit item in any funeral, often marked up 100 to 600%, and therefore the funeral industry and the funeral directors have had a real incentive to make it difficult for others to compete with them, because that's their large profit item. And indeed, the board of funeral directors is made up of funeral directors, hence the limit on the competition. Well, how did that affect somebody in real life? Turns out that after Hurricane Katrina, you had an abbey down there, St. Joseph's Abbey, which is a 125-year-old Benedictine abbey that also had, as part of its calling, work in crafts that they would make available to the community. They needed an additional source of revenue, so they began building very simple but very well-made wooden caskets of the sort they buried the monks in and making them available to the public. It turns out that, and this is where it really boils down to what happens to people trying to do this sort of what should be honest activity. They get the knock on the door, and it turns out they don't just get a cease and desist order. They get a cease and desist order telling them that they are subject to 6 months in jail for every casket they sell and a $2,500 fine for every casket they sell. Now, what does that do to someone, not just the monks, but anyone else who even thinks about it? Of course, it creates a huge disincentive. The monks are fighting back, and we just won the case on their behalf, and this gets back to the Constitution. It turns out that the reason these laws are able to proliferate is that under the way that the law has been interpreted since the New Deal, since one of the sea changes that Phil was talking about, the courts have basically taken themselves out of the business of looking critically at legislative activity when it comes to regulating economic or property matters. And as a result, pretty much anything that is done in the name of economic regulation gets a rubber stamp from the courts. And that is a real problem for people out there in the real world, because it means every time you go into a court, there's a presumption, not in your favor as an individual living in this country where you should be free and responsible individual controlling your own destiny, but rather a presumption in favor of government authority. One other example. Women, I don't think the men in here do it yet, but the women may have done this. Have you ever had your eyebrows threaded? Ever gone to a beautician and had your eyebrows threaded? Well, if it turns out, start noticing this, because once you start noticing it, you'll find that it's all over the place. Look in shopping malls, look in beauty salons. Yeah, they're popping up in a lot of different places, because it turns out in people from Pakistani and Indian heritage, they have a tradition that instead of plucking their eyebrows or removing facial hair with chemicals or something like that, they just use a thread. And it's this very interesting process. It just tweezes thread. It's not painful, and it's very quick and efficient, and it's very popular, and it's very affordable, both for the customer and for the entrepreneur, which all they need is a chair and some thread.
You sound like a salesman for it.
Well, I am. And here you go.
Those lawyers.
Yeah. So it turns out, what's wrong with this? There's no real health and safety challenge there at all. I mean, they don't use any chemicals. They don't use any sharp implements. There's no blood involved. There's no body. I mean, it's just the whole thing's just straight. Well, it turns out that you have to be a fully licensed cosmetologist to do eyebrow threading. And in Texas, like in a number of other states, including Arizona, to become a fully licensed cosmetologist can take anywhere from, 1,500 to 2,000 hours of training, cost up to $20,000. And guess how much you learn about eyebrow threading? Zero. Zero. You learn maybe 5 hours of general sanitation stuff, like wash your hands, use clean string, that sort of thing. And that's all you learn. But you still have to take that test in order to do this eyebrow threading. Well, again, this is the kind of rule of law that is absolutely detrimental and fatal to the spirit of entrepreneurship. It goes back to the sort of cultural points that we were making earlier. The spirit of entrepreneurship that should be flourishing in this country and instead is just smothered bit by bit by bit with these incremental requirements and nonsensical requirements imposed on hardworking men and women. So, what is the answer? There's not one simple answer, but it does start with the Constitution. It starts with the Constitution recognizing that there should be a presumption in favor of liberty, as the founders intended, not one in favor of government. After all, the whole fabric of the Constitution was designed to limit government. And when it comes to economic activity, that should be one in which there is a very real reassessment of the law as it currently stands. And what I hope will be the kind of sea change that Phil talks about. Because clearly, there's never been a time in recent memory where the need for constitutional constraint on government has been greater than it is right now. And nowhere more so, in my opinion, than in the realm of economic liberty.
Thanks, Chip. Can you, before we move on, can you describe a little bit about how... You do litigation.
Yes.
And you have clear constitutional goals in mind with that, but you have research, have a very active kind of public affairs outreach. Can you say how that all fits together?
Sure. We're a public interest law firm, which means our main business is in the courtrooms and our main adversary is the government, both from the federal, state, and local level. But a key insight into what makes us effective is that litigation alone is never enough. It must be accompanied by a very carefully crafted strategic approach that involves public relations and communications, so that a case like an eyebrow threading case, a seemingly innocuous and obscure occupation in Texas, can indeed be elevated to national attention as it has been and is in the process of being done. African hair braiding, another one that got a lot of attention along the years. But all of them being characterized by being able to tell the principle at stake in one case is actually representative of a much larger problem. We also do strategic research, which brings to bear very rigorous social science to look at the nature of the issue we're involved with and document what's going on there. So how prevalent are these regulations? How many food vending trucks? We just did a national study on food vending regulation, it turns out. One of the things they do there to outlaw food trucks is they make proximity restrictions. And it turns out that in a lot of places, again, in Texas recently, to use another example, El Paso said that you couldn't have a vendor selling food within 1,000 feet of any other establishment that sold food items. That includes restaurants, grocery stores, convenience stores, anything that sold. So, of course, the concentric circles overlap to such an extent that basically the whole city's off limits. It's not a prohibition, but it's an effective prohibition. So we document that and then use that as part of the story.
And then, sorry, but also you're... IGA is known for its effectiveness in terms of your public outreach and that sort of thing.
Thanks.
So can you just say a little more about how that fits in, the videos you're doing and that sort of
sure.
thing?
Sure, sure, yes. It turns out that, you know, as part of telling the story, we have to reach the media. And that used to be that we'd just hold a news conference and we'd put out our news release and we'd pound the phones, and we've got great PR people, and we would generate stories with great clients who can really personify the story that's going on. And that worked well. We're 20 years old now. That worked well in the first 15 years of IJ's existence. And indeed, you know, we were known for that, winning about 18 national awards for our media work. But things change. As everyone knows in the media, it's different now. And suddenly videos are a big thing. And Reason does a great job in videos, for instance, where you suddenly have to reach people in their narrow bit of attention. They've got 2 or 3 minutes where you have to boil down and present in dramatic fashion. And we've begun doing that. And those are not replaced, but supplemented the news releases. So they're much more effective at reaching media now than they used to be.
I just say I was at IJ had its 20th anniversary last month, mm-hmm. the month before. And I don't know if anyone else here was there, but yeah, it wasn't it. It was just fantastic.
Oh,
Chip brought in their clients come in, and so you actually get to see these people and who tell these unbelievably moving stories, in part about how IJ has just saved their lives, but also how committed they are now to this cause. And I have never been to anything but a funeral service where I see so many people crying. but it was better than a funeral.
Okay, good.
Anyway, Len, your turn.
Okay, well, it's first of all, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you guys today. It's an honor to be here, and it's also an honor to be on a panel with such esteemed colleagues. My name is Leonard Gilroy. I'm the director of government reform at Reason Foundation. We, like my colleagues here, are a national organization that is sort of free market, libertarian in outlook, and you know we take our mission very seriously in this regard in terms of regulation. And I guess I've always been of the mind that we tend to think of regulation as a one-way street. It is coming from the big government house down that street towards you, right? And I have always been of the mind that we need to be equally proactive in creating a two-way street there, that we should be as equally proactive at trying to regulate our government. And we can't assume that the Constitution and the laws that we put in place are enough. Because as you've heard already, why do we have situations like this where you know, to do something completely innocuous, you have to get a cosmetology license? Why, for instance, does it take, can anyone guess how long it takes to get a highway built today in this country? If you want to build a brand new highway, how long does it take from sort of start from approval to move forward to completion with the regulations that fill in the gap in between? Anybody want?
If everything goes smoothly.
That's right. With that caveat, anyone hazard a guess? Average length of time?
20 years.
No, you're actually a little bit. You're actually a little bit high. It's actually 14. But if you want to know why many of you are sitting in traffic in cities like D.C. or Chicago or Atlanta or L.A., you know that's one of the reasons. Is that once you get the approval to do something, it takes 14 years to get the project advanced, and so that's something that Congress is talking about right now.
Yeah. And the lawsuits.
So just quick by way of introduction, for those, I know there are several of you here that are familiar with Reason, but for those of you that aren't, we are a national organization. We essentially have three business units. We have a think tank, which I am a part of. I'm our director of government reform, and my job is essentially to work with motivated policymakers to advance free market policies and really concentrating in privatization of government services, turning services back from public operation to the private sector, and then also the big, larger bundle of fiscal policy, because these things are all intertwined. But then we also, in addition to that, we have Reason Magazine, which many of you are probably familiar with, which is really a very, very broad take on, a libertarian take on culture, society, politics, really cutting a huge swath across our societal fabric and bringing a libertarian free market approach to those issues. And then also our newest business unit is Reason.tv, which is our our video journalism unit, and many of you have probably seen some of our videos, even if you didn't know it. And you know, there they've done a great body of work to really distill to really what Chip was just saying, which was taking some of these things that years ago we had very crude tools to deliver our messages, and now we live in an era where you've got 5 minutes to catch my attention with a video, go. And that's what we're trying to adapt our message to. And so there you can find some great material on regulation, everything from interior design regulation, a lot of occupational licensing, food trucks, fish pedicures. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but we did some videos on fish pedicures where you will go and these little fish will, I've not done it, so I'm not probably the best to explain it, but you put your feet in a bucket with these little fish that kind of chip away at the dead skin, and you know, it's very, you know, very safe. But apparently, even here, I think it's Mesa. I think you guys were, or maybe your local unit was involved. I'm not sure, but it was Goldwater. I think it's taking this on, the Goldwater Institute, which is a ban on fish pedicures that some city councilman in Mesa wanted to put on. I believe it was Mesa. Anyway,
Your colleague Nick Gillespie had a fish pedicure on national media. He did.
My colleague Nick Gillespie went on John Stossel's show on Fox Business and actually had one on television to demonstrate that this is actually nothing. So anyway, what I wanted to do is just give you a quick take on, from what I see on, and I'm actually, one of our things as a think tank, and I'm in the think tank unit, one of our roles is to not just be a think tank, but actually to be action-oriented, to be an action tank, a do tank, if you will. And so my job is not only to work on policy and to do, you know, your typical think tank work of explaining policy and analyzing it, but also then to distill that down into bite-sized bits that your average legislator or city councilman or governor or whomever can understand and actually make use of. And really, actually, it's their staff. Those guys don't make very many decisions on their own. It's actually, or they don't get a lot of input from their own proactive work. It's they're working with 25-year-old young staffers who are delivering the content to them, and so that's my audience for the work that I do. And so, how can I create messages for them? And so, I wanted to contextualize that as sort of a lessons from the front lines and how we break this, how I tend to see this. I see this in sort of three tiers, and if you give me just a second, I wanted to explain how I see this. Tier one is sort of the low-hanging fruit, and what I mean by that is, there are battles over regulation that happen all the time. The fish pedicures, the occupational licensing, having, you know, a new law proposed or a new, a new occupation to regulate. And so we are often called to jump right into the debates. And let me give you an example, maybe a bigger picture one. Dodd-Frank, financial services regulation. That's one where our economic policy team in D.C. has been very active. The research component, the think tank stuff, if you will, that's a given. We do that in any, you know, type of work that we do. But in addition to the work that they're doing to basically explain the many myriad problems with Dodd-Frank, we are actively engaged in building coalitions of think tanks on our side and other side, the other side as well, to inform the debate and take solutions to policymakers who we're working with on Capitol Hill, by the way, you know, at the same time, to help them unwind some of this. So we're looking for those motivated customers in Congress, and we are working with them to actively, you know, to work on writing the language, to work on the policy, to go testify and support them when they're advancing these. So that's just one example. Those are the battles. Those are short-term battles. Those are real-time activities. Okay. So that's the tier one is current battles. Tier two would be the activities that we and my colleagues here do as well to essentially build firewalls to the existing system. And this is a little different from the battles. This is where you're looking to superimpose systemic changes or tweaks into the system or onto the system to find those small levers that will essentially build big firewalls. And that may be a little arcane, so let me just put that into context. One that was really near and dear to me in the first project I really worked on at Reason, before I was doing privatization policy, I come from the dark side, so to speak, at least from my vantage point as a libertarian now. I look back at it now and say I came from the dark side, which was I was an urban planner. I was out there helping governments regulate things of which I had no clue of what I was doing. And I can guarantee you that the other 40,000 professional urban planners out there are not thinking about the impact of the regulations that they're doing. Nobody makes them do that. What does that mean for you? If you ever try to build a house, if you ever try to add on to your house, if you try to do anything with your property, you run into the proverbial planner. You have to go get a permit. You have to go to City Hall and get approval to do simple things that you would think, well, isn't this my land? Can't I just do that? Can I just build a shed? Can't I just build a fence? No, actually, in many places, you have to go down to City Hall. And actually, not just go down to City Hall, but you have to engage a process. You have to go deal with a bunch of urban planners and planning commissions and bureaucrats to actually get a little document that says you can do this. Okay, the costs of that vary widely, but there are costs to do things that really shouldn't have to bear in the first place. Anyway, the thing that turned me into a libertarian was actually my work as an urban planner, where one day I'm standing there showing a map that we had made of a future land use plan, where essentially my consulting firm was asked to help help a jurisdiction in Louisiana develop a long-range comprehensive land use plan, meaning let's micromanage every piece of land that's in this jurisdiction for the next 30 years. That was the goal. And I had to stand there, and a guy came up to me and pointed at a map that I had actually drawn and said, so on your map, this is where my property is, and you know, according to your map, you want to keep my land in agricultural use. And I looked at it and said, oh, yeah, that's the zone, right? I mean, very technocratic, as my colleagues have said here already, right? Oh, no, that's the zone. That's the zone that you would be in. Yes, sir. And then he asked me a question that turned on the light bulb and changed my life forever, which was, well, everybody around me right now, all my neighbors, they've been able to subdivide their property. They're building houses right now, and you're telling me that if we put in this new thing that you guys are talking about, that I won't be able to develop my property and reap the economic gain that I don't get the benefit of the bargain of what I bought into when I bought this property. I bought it, and the government here said that I could subdivide this in these ways. And now they're going to come back and tell me I can't. I have to leave it farm property. Chip knows this very well, but that's actually something, it's called regulatory takings. And that's something where we have a pathetic history in this country. In fact, I would argue that, the urban planning profession has wrought massive destruction on our country by imposing regulations like that. Long story short, I don't think that ever went through. I quit that job a couple weeks later after that, and luckily Reason Foundation was looking for an urban policy analyst, and that's how I came there. So one of the first things I got to really engage a few years ago, when Chip and IJ were doing really excellent work on eminent domain reform, I was trying to find another niche because they were doing such a great job that I tried to go at the same time when there was a lot of momentum and work on regulatory taking. And ballot measures were enacted or were proposed in four different states on this issue, and I'm proud to tell, which would basically impose the firewall on that system. And what it would say is, basically, if you regulate someone's property in that way such that it diminishes the value of their property, which it would if you said you can't subdivide your property and sell it off for houses, now you have to leave it as agricultural. Well, all of a sudden the use of your property is limited. Now your economic benefit or potential from that property has just gotten, you know, slashed. Well, Oregon passed a measure a few years ago, a ballot measure that basically required government to compensate landowners when that happened, which was a huge firewall to come in. Now, that has gotten dismantled, unwound, and Oregon's a particularly unique case. Although, out of the result of that, I will tell you is that today you're sitting in a state that actually has not only done some pretty good reforms on the eminent domain side, which you know, I know Chip is very familiar with, but also, at the same time, took on the regulatory takings issue. So that was actually one of those success stories. This was the only one in that round of all the other states that were looking at this. But basically, putting firewalls into place where now policymakers have to actually account for those actions before they make them, which they used to do by default. And then the last one, I know I've got quick, not much time. And this is the bigger picture. The third tier of action in the regulatory reform front is the hardest one. And I think that's actually the place where philanthropists and you all have a great role to play. This is in the dust bunnies. I call this the dust bunny problem. It's what my colleagues here referred to earlier, which is we just accumulate all these regulations, right? And so you look at a book of regulations and it's, you know, they just accumulate. And I call those dust bunnies, right? I mean, these are dust bunnies. They've been sitting around for 50 years, you know, 70 years, 80 years. Who knows how long these things have been sitting around? But we build up dust bunnies in regulation and we rarely clean them out. We rarely lift the rug and sweep and, you know, clean these things out. And the reason why is because obviously the complexity, I mean, you're talking about layers and layers and layers and layers of regulation. And the complexity of doing that is a gargantuan effort. And today when governors, legislators, whomever are coming into office, they are dealing with massive budget deficits, pension liabilities, Medicaid. I mean, they've got all of these issues that are going on at once. And then if we as taxpayers expect them to also go and dive in with the vigor and rigor that it takes to unwind, you know, decades of regulation, that is a fantasy. They do not have the capacity to do that. They don't have the attention span to do that. And so those initiatives can be very challenging without the support of organizations like ours and organizations like yours. And, you know, in addition to, you know, funding groups that do things that, like, you know, along the lines that we're all talking about, there's also the ability to just basically fund the reform efforts of those innovators that you see out there. Go and help a mayor, you know, build support and build the capacity with funds and resources to help them do the analytic deep dive that it takes to really start unwinding these things. Help them fund the commission or task force that it takes that otherwise wouldn't have any funding and would get really, you know, very few outcomes. I've seen this over and over again in my work advising folks like Governor Christie, Governor Jindal here in Arizona, Governor Brewer. I've been a part of task forces and commissions on unwinding just, you know, government services and privatizing things. I can tell you from that, just asking how much do we spend as a state to change a light bulb, you can never answer those questions adequately. So then to take it from there and to wonder, well, how can we undo the layers of regulations? Those are very difficult things, and that, I think, is a big role for philanthropy. So with that, I guess I'd wrap up and would love to hear your questions. So thank you.
Thanks, Lynn. To what extent, you focus on privatization and these regulatory issues, to what extent does privatization solve any of these regulatory issues, or are they just, you know, transposed into the private arena?
There is some overlap. And that's a great question. Those bubbles do overlap sometimes, but not in very intuitive ways. Sometimes privatization can be the alternative to regulation. Actually, you can privatize something and actually, by contract, achieve the regulatory goal or the goals of the regulation that you maybe had there in the first place. So basically, by putting performance measures in contracts, you can get the same goal with a lot less burden. So I think there is some overlap, but oftentimes they're just different spaces.
And are you? I'd actually like to ask this question of all you guys: is to what extent are you dealing with local versus state versus federal regulations, and what's the interplay between those? And is it easier or harder to address some as opposed to others?
We were just looking at this last week. The layering of law has been amazing. I mean, it's amazing. You know, you get elected to some political job, city council of the city of New York or the city of Los Angeles, and you want to do something. So you put in I just wrote an op-ed on this yesterday. You put in a rule, a law, a local ordinance prohibiting discrimination against the disabled. Well, there's already two federal statutes, two really significant ones that overlap that. As well as some state statutes. They're all layered on top. And then it's all layered, and then in this case, they bring a lawsuit to force that all taxis in New York City be disabled accessible, which turns out will cost $935 million every 5 years. Or if you divide it, depending on who you believe, by the number of people who are disabled who will use the taxis, it's either $2,000 per ride or $63,000 per ride. And so, all because of a layering of laws, which judges can seize on any or all of which to do something. And again, it goes to the point where it sort of needed spring cleaning.
Mm-hmm. And I, again, if I could just build on what Phil is saying, I agree with what he just said. And I would add to it that in the constitutional context there, what you're really faced with is it's a problem with federalism or the lack of federalism recognized and protected under the Constitution, such that you now have the proliferation of these laws coming from the top all the way down through the system. And they're either just imposed by fiat or they're incentivized by funding. Mm-hmm. And so once you take the money, basically you're stuck if you're a state or a city. And the conditions that go with that are part of the game. So it's all oftentimes one big mess, but in our experience at least, the problems that these laws create that most immediately affect people in their everyday lives tend to flow from the local and state level. Because that's where you've got the housing permit, that's where you've got the occupational licensing laws, that's where you've got these things that people really have to deal with, not the things that they hope they'd never have to deal with, which maybe they can avoid at the federal level.
Does that make it for donors, say, who are focused on their own regions? Does that make the fact that so many stem from local regional things, does that make it easier for them to find ways to address this, do you think?
Let me just say yes and no. So doing a local first of all, doing litigation is very, which is what CHIP does, is really targeted and really efficient. Because you look at the ultimate goal, which is our people are free to do the right thing. And you get to these points where they're clearly not, and you ignore all the stuff I talk about. You just say, this violates the Constitution, and it doesn't matter what all these other laws have been piled up. And so for the extreme cases, very efficiently, IJ has done a great job for 20 years. I mean, it's just but it doesn't apply to all the problems of society or all the regulatory problems. It applies, which is unfortunately a larger band where people aren't free. The problem with doing regulatory reform at a state or local level, and we're just talking with some people in Oklahoma about doing it, about basically de-bureaucratizing Oklahoma's public schools. It's going to be an initiative to bulldoze public school bureaucracy. Because why do you need bureaucracy in a public school any more than you need it in a parochial school? I mean, it's really just, it just isn't needed, except on a really fairly thin level. Is that it goes to this PR point. The public has to be in the mood for reform to do it. They have to get in the mood for it. And maybe you can do with public schools on a local level with Oklahoma Media. But by and large, if we don't have a national refocusing on how modern, the accretion of law has made everyone powerless and made it impossible to balance budgets, do the big things as well as do the small things in your lives. If we don't have a national recognition of that, I don't think you get big change at any level. In other words, you sort of need to get the, it's just that kind of network problem. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to think anymore. It sort of needs to get channeled in a way that's perhaps somewhat more specific than the Tea Party has, which is not, in my view, get rid of government. You're not going to get rid of EPA or FDA or stuff. But understand how stupidly they work. So that it becomes, humans given responsibility who can then be fired when they're jerks. Whereas today, go find the enemy. You can't find the enemy. It's the blob.
And it's a hard issue, right? Because it's not that costs are often hidden, the effects are, they just pile up little by little, right? And it's not like taxes when you pay your taxes.
It affects people. People get it. I mean, the right, again, all the surveys, people really do understand that it's stupid. And you give them some fact. They understand that the medical system's really stupid and too bureaucratic. They understand that it's broken. They understand the schools are broken. If you give them the fact, they understand that it's stupid for the average cost of a new drug in this country to be $2.3 billion. They understand that that's an impediment to innovation in the, in pharmaceutical.
You're an optimist. Kurt, it was a good session. And thank you guys very much. We appreciate it.